The Millennial Express, plowing ever onward through a northern winter. From station to station, bringing the dissident right to you.
Hello, and welcome back to Millennial 2023. This is the 12th night, I believe, yes. And we've got five streams. In a while, it will be Zeitgeist Reviews, then Collective Dismal, then Mr. D, and then finally there will be an AMA just with me on my own for the winter solstice, because that is tomorrow. But first, it is the Traditional Britain Group. Now, the Traditional Britain Group have appeared quite a few times before on Millennial. They are a mainstay of, I don't know what you would say, right-wing politics, the disaffected right-wing politics, the types like us who aren't very happy with the way the country is in Britain. Gregory Lauder-Frost, would you like to introduce the TBG for people?
Yes, well, good evening, Colin. I think the Traditional Britain Group is about just that. It's about a traditional Britain. It's about opposing everything that's wrong, all the terrible legislation we've had over the last 50 years, opposing all the oppression and the denial of our rights via legislation, opposing hate crimes, opposing all of those who want to make the nuclear family totally irrelevant. We want a traditional Britain. We want the norms that our ancestors enjoyed. We don't want degenerate progress. People that have talked about progress in the last 200 years, in many respects, social progress, and I don't mean getting women and children out of the mines and that sort of thing. That's, of course, that's right. But I mean, the sort of things we've seen in the last four or five decades is completely wrong, completely and utterly wrong, morally repugnant. And I think that's what we oppose. We want a return to civility, to normality, to a bit of discipline in society. And instead of the anarchy that we are seeing today, which is a sort of liberal fascism, really. It's or a libertarian fascism. It's a sort of total anarchy. And if you oppose it, you're accused immediately of being far right or Nazi or Nazi sympathizer or fascist or, oh, you know. And instead of discussing anything, instead of arguing or debating, they close you down with all the catchwords. Well, we're here. We'll take the catchwords, but it's not going to stop us. We're going to continue fighting for what is right, fighting for a normal, decent, respectable society. And we will continue also opposing alien immigration into our island, the most densely populated country in Europe. Most people don't know that. We have five times more people per square mile in Britain than France does. Well,
that's incredible.
It can't continue. It can't continue. And we are here. And we're going to continue being very, very vocal until something's done. We are betrayed by the people at Westminster, and they have tried very hard to close organisations like us down, decent people, everyday people carrying on everyday lives. They want to silence us so that their liberal fascism and their socialism can continue to destroy our society.
All right. That's a very good summary there. And we'll also here is Andrew Norfolk. Andrew Moffat. Andrew, would you like to introduce yourself and to TBG people in your own words?
Yes. Can you hear me all right there?
Yes.
Colin, thank you for having me on. It's good to talk to our listeners again. And I'd just like to go back to what you said by way of your introduction. You said that we were the disaffected right. Well, we are disaffected, but we're not sort of revolutionaries. We represent and stand up for the ordinary man and woman in the street. Our views, I have no doubt, they're the views of the majority. And if you talk to people in the local pub or on the railway station or whatever it is, most people hold the same traditional views as we do. And they're absolutely astonished at how these governments, one after the other, can carry on dismantling the infrastructure of the nation state. All of the parties, there's hardly a cigarette paper between them, and they represent what you might call the uniparty. That's the Tories, Labour, the Lib Dems, and the SNP. They all stand for the same thing. And I bumped into an MP at a station, a railway station, a few months ago, and I confronted him. And more people should do that when they see these people. I confronted him, and I said, I took him to task on immigration and on a number of other things too, on the LGBT agenda in schools and in academia, on the Ukraine war, which is really a proxy war where the Ukrainians, who have now lost 400,000 people, 400,000 men, are fighting a war on behalf of the United States of America. I confronted him on the lockdowns, on the vaccinations, on the climate change, on the people coming in over the channel, on all of these things and more. And he looked at me and he said, and you're accusing me of being responsible for all of this, are you? And I replied to him, I said, yes, I am. I said, you're a government minister, and you're a part of it. I said, you're not a conservative politician, you're a red revolutionary. And I think that sums it up. These people aren't conservative. There's nothing conservative about their revolutionary policies. They are, in effect, red revolutionaries. They're destroying the fabric of the nation state. They're destroying our national infrastructure, our traditions, our culture, and our heritage. And there is a deliberate policy of displacement and replacement in order to render obsolete the nation state. And anyone can see that with just a modicum of thought. And that is what's going to happen without any consultation or consent whatsoever from the indigenous people. And we have a sort of a compact between our ancestors of the past, those living today, and future generations, most of whom are unborn. We are trustees for the future, and we're passing on an inheritance that will cease to exist within one generation's time, when we will be reduced to minority status in our own ancestral homeland, which is going to end up in absolute bedlam.
Yeah, I completely agree with all of that. Well done for taking one of these politicians to task. And I should clarify, I didn't use the word disaffected in a pejorative or mocking sense. After all, I apply it to myself just as much as anyone else. But I certainly I simply mean that we feel there isn't a political party for us. Maybe there's a better word for it, dispossessed. There is no party representing us. And as you say, I think our views are not actually that unusual at all. In fact, I think most people, if they were being honest, would agree with us. And the extremists are the people who call us extremists. The extremists are the ones who are drastically, radically changing the country without the consent of the public and as much as possible without the knowledge of the public, without them being aware, actively lying and misleading them about the situation so that they'll go along with it, so that they'll keep quiet while they're replaced and their culture is degraded. So, yeah, I just want to clarify. I think the extremists are the people who are doing this, and we just want normality. We just want sanity, and we just want a healthy, decent society back. That is all. So I certainly don't see us as extremists. So, Gregory, we said that we were going to talk about the events of the year, and it has been a fairly full year. What would you see as some of the most salient events of 2023?
Well, when it comes to alien immigration, whether legal or illegal, the government have totally and utterly failed, as they did the previous year and the previous year and the previous decade and the previous decade. And so we now have millions of aliens in our country. The government doesn't know how to stop them. They can't control our borders. They are impotent. The Germans who are all now dead, if they were still alive, who were in the last World War, would be laughing out loud that the British can't now, today, protect their own borders. They cannot stop boats from coming in. So, you know, we've had over a million aliens have come in boats, and we have been unable to stop them. Well, I imagine the Germans would have been very pleased if they'd had an army a million strong to invade Great Britain. And what we have to ask ourselves is, why is it that our government is still in the outdated and unworkable 1951 refugee, United Nations Refugee Charter? And why are they continuing to sign other refugee pacts when there's no room here for anyone? There's no room here for a single refugee. The government never, ever says to any person coming in as a refugee or an asylum seeker, they never say to them, it says in the UN Charter, you must seek refuge in the very first free country to that which you're fleeing from. Well, Britain is, you know, almost in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean, where we are about the last country, unless we consider Iceland. And the government doesn't enforce any of the laws. They don't enforce anything. They're completely unrepresentative. I think on not just on the immigration issue, but, you know, this LGBT stuff, the transgender garbage, God knows how many of these ludicrous things. The government only represents minorities today. They represent only minorities. They have forgotten totally about the majority. They have forgotten about the British people. The British people who still live here, the 87% of the population who are indigenous British European people, they have forgotten about them. They don't represent us. And so when the general election comes along, you know, people get the same old choice. You know, you vote for one to keep the other out, all this sort of garbage. And we get the same musical chairs every time at Westminster. So all this legislation that they're bringing in, they've even brought in, can you believe it, a minister for common sense. We wouldn't need a minister for common sense if we didn't have a whole raft of ludicrous, insulting and outrageous pieces of legislation already on the statute book. So they've brought in a minister to try and put right everything that they have already put wrong. You know, it's just a joke, really. I mean, it's a joke.
Do you think that that minister is expected to actually change anything? I doubt it. I think it's just a sop.
It's just a job for the boys. They just get another ministerial salary on top of their Member of Parliament salary. So, you know, the whole thing is an insult and a slap in the face. You take issues like the death penalty. Every poll that has ever been taken on the death penalty since it was abolished in the 1960s has said that the majority of the population want to see the death penalty reinstituted. You know, it wasn't the actual penalty that was wrong. It was the cock-ups in the judicial system. And that's what they had to sort out. But people now are getting away with anything and everything. Every day I turn on the you know, the media channels, and I see rapes after rapes. I see murders. I see stabbings every single day. Well, what is the government? You know, we have no, don't this government see anything? I mean, what, you know, where are they, these people? What are they looking at? All they seem to be concerned with about is stupid inquiries, one inquiry after the other. And it's taking people's attention away from the real fundamental issues that our country faces on every level. We see the march through the institutions by the broad left, by the liberals, by the socialists in organizations like the Arts Council, you name it. They're there. And the Conservative Party, the fake Conservative Party, have done nothing to stop this. They have done nothing to stop the march of the left through our institutions. And it's continued all through this year. I don't know what's going to happen in the future. I take on board in the past year, the reports from the French military intelligence and the letters to the French, the main French newspapers, by about 20 or 25 generals and senior ranking officers in the French military, who suggest that a civil war in France is coming. I don't wish for a civil war, but I do think that if anyone's engineering civil wars, it's the politicians. The politicians who are out of touch and who are now peddling a liberal socialist agenda on every subject, on every possible subject. What is worse is that because the liberal left took over the education system under the Conservatives, they continued to take over the education system, that we now see people coming into the judiciary who were educated in, say, the 1990s, and they're coming into the judiciary, and they're left. They're all left. And so, you know, if you go up on one of these trumped up political charges like a hate crime or some complete and utter garbage, you really don't have a chance, because the person that's been assigned to represent you probably doesn't believe, or may even tell you openly that that they don't really believe in anything that you believe in. And then, of course, the judges and the magistrates are the same. They are of the liberal left. And so you're not even going to get justice anymore. So all this has happened not just in the last year, but in the last year and previous years. It's a rolling stone. It's a rolling stone. And the man in the street has to sit up and start thinking before it's too late. And it may already be too late. And it's no use just saying, oh, that Gregory Lord of Frost, I'm just a complete fascist, you know, just some sort of Nazi, blah, 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 blah. No. I wasn't brought up like that. I didn't grow up like that. I've always had good jobs, proper jobs, normal jobs. I'm a family man. I've got children. And I believe in common decency. I believe in the right of free speech. And I believe in all the things that are now being taken away from us all. So are we this dissident right? Well, we believe we are right. And we believe we are the real conservatives. Certainly, the only thing thing that's conservative about the current Conservative Party is its title. And that, if people can't see that, well, I think that they're either ignoramuses or there's something drastically wrong. You know, it's just astonishing. And I think next year we're going to see an election, isn't it? Next year it's due.
And, yes, I think it has to be before January 25. So
yeah, which means it'll be next year sometime. I think that the past year has seen so many calamities of every possible nature. Arguments in Parliament about whether, you know, schools should have same-sex toilets, and, you know, I mean, the whole thing is insulting. It's beyond a joke. And our children are being brainwashed in the schools at a very young age on a whole range of issues, whether they're sexual or racial or all kinds of subjects. They are being taught lies. I couldn't possibly go to one of my children and say, well, you know that there's 30 genders out there, and it's just not male and female. I'm sure that even an eight-year-old would look at you and think there was something wrong with you if you told them that. And I think that, excuse me, it's all going down the hole. And what we really need, proportional representation, so that new parties have a chance. Excuse me.
Don't worry.
Apologize. I think that new parties have a chance to get a leg on the ladder and to get into Parliament without being completely excluded by our current archaic electoral system, where more people vote against the party that gets into government, and worse, their votes are binned. They mean nothing. So, you know, it's not democracy. We hear more and more every day government talking about democracy and this democracy and democracy that and democracy this. Well, it's nothing to do with democracy because they don't believe in democracy because they have a completely undemocratic electoral system, which is keeping everybody but themselves out of Westminster. So, I mean,
out of power. Thank you. I'll bring in Andrew. Andrew, what would you say about this? Because it seems to me that this is a key part of the problem. The voting system ensures that the status quo continues and that the two main parties just continually vibe for meaningless power against each other when there's nothing to choose between them. Would you say that first past the post is past its prime, so to speak?
Well, it is in many respects, and the irony is we haven't got any competition between the parties. They represent one big uniparty with a few degrees variance on the left and a few degrees variance on the right. That's all it is. Unfortunately, people will vote for their tribal party of choice based upon the lesser of the evil. They won't vote for minority parties because they haven't got much chance of getting in. It's the same in the United States. They have inherited most of their infrastructure from us, their political infrastructure. You've got the Democratic Party and the Republican Party, and more or less nothing in between. It's very difficult to mount any sort of opposition. And don't forget also that you're not just opposing the parties, you're opposing the huge resources those parties have, the millions available to them from their backers, many of whom are not of British descent anyway. There's all sorts of elements in this country now backing these parties for globalist purposes. Anyone can see that the parties do not represent the majority on many of the salient points that now afflict us. So it needs to have a change. Don't forget also we're fighting against the media. The media and the old political parties, the uniparty, they work hand in glove with each other. They lean on each other. I made a number of points earlier on when I first spoke about several issues where no dissent whatsoever is permitted. One was the mass vaccination policy and the lockdown policy, absolutely flawed on a number of different issues. Don't forget that Sweden had no lockdown they were unafflicted. They haven't as a result incurred the enormous debt burden that we've now incurred, which has caused taxes to reach their highest proportion of GDP since the Second World War, all based on a lockdown policy that was absolutely pointless. There's now a government inquiry into this, which has already reached, I have no doubt, absolutely no doubt, it's already reached its conclusions, and all the people who should be permitted to speak, those people who oppose lockdown, those overseas, such as in Florida and Texas, the leading scientists, such as Dr. Mike Yaden, head of pharmaceutical research at Pfizer, people like that are airbrushed out. They're not allowed to provide their views. I can go on to this in great depth. Some of our colleagues overseas, such as Christine Anderson of the AFD, in the Health Committee of the European Parliament, they had the Pfizer representative up there, and the Pfizer representative had to admit that no tests had been done to see whether the vaccines stopped infection between people. Absolutely no tests, and yet we were all told we had to take a test we had to take a vaccine in order to save Granny, to prevent her becoming infected. There are other issues. The Ukraine war, for instance, there's no dissent permitted on that. Climate change, there's no dissent despite all the tens of thousands of scientists who have an alternative opinion about this. The LGBT agenda in schools, virtually no dissent permitted on that. And in fact, we've got the very opposite. We've got this government, it's just introduced the online safety bill, which could afflict channels such as your own.
Indeed.
It will be up to, I think, Ofcom to determine if a channel is passing on misinformation or disinformation. Something that is absolutely tyrannical, which, if taken to its ultimate ambition, will snuff out all sorts of opposition in the same way that Zelensky has snuffed out his opposition in the Ukraine. That's what they're doing now. It's highly ominous, and they dress it up, as they always do. They dress these things up under a facade. There's always window dressing going on here, and they said it's to protect children. That's what it was all about. Well, it's nothing to do with protecting children. If they had any idea, any desire to protect children, they wouldn't be imposing the LGBT agenda on five-year-olds in schools. So it gives the lie to that straight away.
Well, also, you can't say that, I mean, discourse, political discourse, philosophical discourse on the internet is not children who are taking part in that, it's adults. So if you're going to say that you have to make all of this suitable for children, I mean, you have to treat the entire adult population as if they're, what, seven-year-olds. That's effectively what they're doing here. In order to make it safe for children, well, yeah, you have to retard the entire thing. Adults don't need the same level of protection as children. So this is absolutely, I mean, just on its face, this is a terrible and stupid approach. I also think it shows the tendency
of course,
a very feminized world to treat everyone like a mother treats her children.
Yes, and what is this dissent that they're talking about? What is this misinformation and disinformation? They're discussing this all the time now, but it's always directed at alternatives to the mainstream media. And because the mainstream media is not prepared to provide any alternative opinion, then members of the public are going elsewhere. And they're finding that there are scientists, people of considerable reputation and learning, who have alternative opinions, which they can demonstrate to be factually correct. Because they've been airbrushed out by the establishment media through a very unusual connection which has become closer and closer between the government and the media. I think it was described as the fourth estate of the media. People are searching for alternative views, and the government doesn't like it. They're seeking to crush that dissent. We're moving very swiftly in a direction that is ominous and which we've seen amongst the big dictatorships of the last century. And frankly, we don't want it here.
No, of course, but the public, I don't think, ever wanted any of this. The issue is that the establishment have imposed this artificially. It's very much their agenda. Gregory, I think you want to chime in here. You're nodding away there.
Well, it is an agenda. And this is what prompts our criticism of the fake Conservative Party, because it is a Marxist agenda. And people laugh when you say this, but the fact of the matter is that Marx was very clear that the new world, his new world, could not get off the ground until the old world was destroyed. And the old norms were destroyed. And, you know, this is what's happening, basically. And I also want to come in on what Andrew was saying about Ukraine, because, you know, over the past year, this conflict in Ukraine has continued. And the British keep running over there. Why? Why do they keep running over there? British government ministers? Why? Why would they be running all the way into the Caucasian steppes almost when it's nothing to do with Great Britain, because they go there because they are puppets of the United States, because they do everything that the United States tells them to do. And they feed our intelligence services with the false information that the CIA manufacture. And these are not conspiracy theories. They are shown time and again to be factual. We can go right back to the Iraq War, when the Americans told the British that they had absolutely firm, solid, wonderful information that the Iraqi government had weapons of mass destruction. And so they went into that country and they completely destroyed the whole infrastructure. They killed over 100,000 people. They wrecked a perfectly stable country. Okay, it might have been under a dictator, but so what? Again, what's that got to do with us? Nothing. And they went in and they wrecked the country. And they found, what did they find? They found there were no weapons of mass destruction. So all of those lies that were fed to our intelligence services by the CIA and these Yankee warmongers across the pond sent a country to its death, and in doing so, dragged us into it and killed loads of and maimed loads of our young men. It's just completely unacceptable. And then we followed them into Afghanistan, of all places. What on earth were we doing in Afghanistan? It's an absolute scandal. And yet no one says anything. Again, hundreds of our young men dead, hundreds wounded, maimed, blinded. Why? What for? What interest was there for Great Britain in Afghanistan? None. The Americans said, you have to help. You have to back us up. Why do we have to back them up? We should be getting out of NATO and just being neutral like Austria and Switzerland. If they can do it, we can do it. We are a little island. We are not a big empire anymore. We are not a great power. And just because we have a couple of nuclear submarines, people become delusional that we are some sort of wonder power as we were in 1900. We're not. We're not. And there's no reason for us to be in this Yankee proxy force running around all over the world into countries that we have no beef with, destroying the countries, killing tens of thousands of hundreds of thousands of people, and causing heartbreak and heartache to mothers and families here in Britain. And they're sitting at their tables, at their dinner tables, saying, what did my son die for? What did he die for? Well, nobody can tell you that, madam, because we don't know what he died for. We died because our politicians did the Americans' bidding. This has got to stop. We need parliamentarians that are going to stand up for Britain and stop all this megalomania of a great power. We are not a great power. And we have terrible problems here in Great Britain that must be addressed. We do not have the money, and we cannot send our young men to die in countries that have nothing to do with us and where we have no interests. And Ukraine is one of them. This is a Slav family quarrel. Let them get on with it. Stop sending money to them that we do not have. We do not have this money. We are borrowing it. We are borrowing money to send to the Ukraine. Can you believe that?
It's completely insane. But before we get to Ukraine, Andrew's been wanting to chime in here.
Well, yes, Britain's raised several issues. I can't remember at what point I was coming in there, but on the Ukraine... Just to remind people, perhaps, because not everyone will know, and I must say, I'm not a fan of Putin. He doesn't. His opinions aren't my opinions, but nor are Zelensky's. And to remind those people who don't know, this war began from a number of sources, but one of the most important was the fact that the Ukraine had been shelling its eastern provinces for 8 years before eventually the Russians acted. Now, had the French been shelling the Channel Islands, I think we'd have done something about it within hours, not after waiting for 8 years. And eventually the Russians did do something. They were asked to for protection by the Russian speakers in the eastern Ukraine, and in they came. But the idea that Zelensky is some sort of a democrat is very far from the truth. He's closed down his opponents in the media and his opposition politicians. He's running what, to all intents and purposes, is a dictatorship. He's now lost about 400,000 Ukrainian soldiers, the very opposite of what most decent civilized people would wish. And that is a peace agreement which has been offered by the Russians. It hasn't been accepted because the Americans won't permit it. We have no business in this war. We're a nation that has an enormous debt burden. The immediate after effect of the war was an enormous rise in food prices, which many of our poor people were finding very hard to meet, and a huge increase in energy prices. Well, those factors still appertain, and this is the result of Britain getting involved in an overseas dispute where we have no interests to protect, no British industry, no British citizens, and no historical interests whatsoever, and therefore we should cease. We've now got an armed service which is smaller than the Weimar Republic after World War I, which they were restricted to as of duty of 100,000 soldiers. We're down to about 80,000 now, and it's getting smaller.
Yeah, this idea that Britain is a huge international player militarily is obviously off the past. It's often surprising when one hears statistics like the one that Andrew just gave there, that statistics that indicate just how small our armed forces now are and our military capability. I don't really know why it's come to why this has come about. I guess it's just economics and the priorities of successive governments. But one way or another, we are simply not the power that we were. It's very much like that's 100 years ago and more. So, Gregory, you were talking about Ukraine, and I interrupted you. Sorry about that.
Andrew, you go first.
Sorry, who's going first?
Andrew.
Well, I just want to say, we're talking about the diminution of our armed forces. One thing which has expanded exponentially, of course, are our civil servants. We've got armies of civil servants now, armies overseeing every single minor aspect of our lives. Anti-discrimination civil servants in the National Health Service, they're in every single government department, especially the Home Office, absolutely riddled with them. It's worth looking back in 1900, Great Britain, despite its enormous empire, we had a civil service of about 4,000 people. That's all it was. That oversaw an empire of about a quarter of the world's landed surface. It was possible in Britain to travel from one part of the country to the other, and you were hardly aware of the reach of the state. At the very most, post offices, perhaps, but almost nothing else. There was nothing else to determine that there was a functioning state above that level. And although the state functioned well and efficiently, it demonstrated that we were free in this country. There weren't nosy parkers intruding into every minor area of our lives. So I just want to make that point because it demonstrates the changes we've overgone over just over 100 years, 120 years, where we've got this enormous civil servant service, which is costing a fortune with their gold-plated pensions and all the various other things. Whereas when we had that huge empire, we had merely 4,000 civil servants. So there we are, just something to chew on, perhaps.
Indeed. Gregory.
Well, nobody would love it more for Great Britain to be a great power than myself. But we're not. It's just that simple, really. We are borrowing money on the money markets every single week. Not just 10 quid, but vast billions of pounds. All of which technically is the responsibility of the British taxpayer. They don't get asked. And our government is reckless in so many ways. Hundreds of millions here, hundreds of millions there. Look at this stupid, idiotic Rwanda scheme. They didn't need to do any of that. They could have addressed the whole thing here and just deported people. Under our laws, they're spending hundreds of millions sending a few hundred to Rwanda, and it's a nonsense. Everywhere I look, the government just wastes millions and millions, hundreds of millions or billions of pounds, and they don't seem to realize this is not their money. It's not their money. It's our money. And the Ukraine war is just another example of a complete and absolute waste of our taxpayers' money. And the other thing I'd like to mention is all these Ukrainian so-called refugees. I mean, once again, Britain was not the closest free country to the Ukraine. There are loads of countries that these so-called refugees could have gone to, but they came here because they get all the handouts, all the largesse, the housing, and they can live off the state. And it's unacceptable. This kind of socialist mentality is completely unacceptable when we have people here who can't pay their electricity bills. This is just not on. Only half of Ukraine is affected by this conflict. Why couldn't these people have gone to cities, towns, and villages in the half of the Ukraine that is not affected by the conflict? Why did they even have to leave the Ukraine? Because this was a chance, that's why. It was a chance to get out of a country that is more like the third world than like the first. And I just think that yet again we see a whole, not just a government, but a whole House of Commons. I won't even mention the parlous state of the House of Lords, but the House of Commons that is out of touch, unrepresentative of their constituents, and I think that something has to snap eventually. Something has to give. It can't go on and on like this, because you couldn't have a bank account and just keep borrowing until the figures ran into billions, could you? And the only reason that we're not in the same situation that Greece was in is because Greece couldn't service their ridiculous loans. We, so far, we are servicing our loans because we are borrowing continuously, and we are able to use some of the money that we've just borrowed to pay off the interest or the loans themselves that we previously had. Actually, it's just, it's like Mickey Mouse economics. And, you know, and we look at Ukraine and why did our staple prices have to go up? Because there was a war in Russia. Why? Nobody's told us that. I mean, we didn't buy oil from Russia. We didn't buy gas from Russia. So why did our prices have to go up? Why did a bag of coal go from £18 to £32? You know, that's what a lady said to me up the street the other day. Why am I paying £32? This is a pensioner. I mean, there's no gas where she lives. The whole thing is beyond bizarre.
Yeah, it's just incredible what our government have done here.
Our government is responsible for this. Our government, make no mistake about this. If anyone says, why am I paying more for my electricity? Why am I paying more for this? Forget about saying, oh, it's the war in Ukraine. That's all crap. It's our government who have done this. Our government put our people in this position. This government deserves to be voted out at the next election. And people say, that'll let Labour in. Well, you tell me what the fundamental difference will be if Labour got in. What would be the fundamental difference that you can think of, especially socially, if Labour got in? There won't be any difference. They'd be just the same. It's just musical chairs at Westminster.
I mean, we need
change.
Yeah.
We need change.
The last 13 years under the Tories has been very left-wing, with gay marriage, the rise of trans craziness, of course, the huge numbers of immigrants have come in. And the government's done nothing to stop it. So it's very left-wing under the Tories. I guess the question is, could it be even more chaotic and left-wing under Labour? It's an interesting question. I really don't know how it could be more left-wing under Labour, but maybe that is actually possible. Andrew?
Well, we've got an complete idiot running the Labour Party. Wasn't he the person who couldn't tell the difference between a man and a woman? To ask him the genetic difference, the physiological differences, he was incapable of answering. And when Andrew Marr, I think it was Andrew Marr, who asked him, is it unfair to say that a woman has a cervix? It was something like that. He dilly-dilly-dallied. So a complete idiot. Well, you couldn't make this stuff up. You really couldn't. But let's just focus a little bit further on the Conservative Party, because they're the people in government at the moment, and they promised a few years ago, when there was a general election in the offing, as they always do, they get their union flag out of the cupboard, blow all the dust off it, they wag it around to pretend they're standing for the for Britain, for the British Constitution, for all the good things we all understand about Britain, which they've sought once in office to undermine piece by piece. And yet, despite that pledge to bring immigration down into the tens of thousands, they've increased it, running at something like 750,000 and 1.3 million gross. Did I mention that earlier on? This is a deliberate policy of displacement and replacement of the British public. Now, the amount that this is costing, the boat people coming across the Channel, that's costing £4 billion just for a start. And yet most of them are coming in through airports and other methods. Those coming in via the Channel is just a very small proportion. It is leading to a situation, it's a helter-skelter situation, to reduce our people to a minority within a generation. And that's going to happen unless we can find an alternative. And unfortunately, there are no alternatives. Whether needs must will eventually produce something, it remains to be seen. And at the same time, taxes are going up. We have a situation which economists refer to as financial repression. This is whereby inflation erodes away the real earnings of the working man, working man and woman, and at the same time, allowances are held static. So with the personal allowances held static, the cost of living rising, wages going up generally beneath inflation, which has been the picture over the last decade or so, the average standard of living for the average person has been diminishing. And we are fast becoming a third world nation. We've been overtaken by many before, some of which we used to govern in the past, simply because we're wasting money, not in our own interests, but on overseas causes such as overseas aid, this Ukraine war, the senseless lockdown, which nearly doubled our national debt, and various other globalist projects which this government has implemented without the support of the British public. So if you want more of the same, then the answer is go out and vote for the Conservative Party. And perhaps even more, go out and vote for the Labour Party. But I'll tell you what, I don't think even the Labour Party would have got away with what the Conservatives have got away with over the last 5 years. And if you look back over the last 50 or 60 years, more immigrants have come in under Conservatives, Home Secretaries, than ever they have under Labour Home Secretaries. Now, I'm not exonerating Labour from this, because, as we know, huge numbers came in under the Blair regime, and they've been big advocates of the displacement of the displacement policy which the Conservatives have undertaken. They're just as guilty as the others. So what we need is a return to basic concepts of patriotism and of governments that put the national interest and the British people first beyond all other interests. It really is quite simple. We don't need brain scientists or rocket scientists to work this out. We need to have ordinary patriotic people whose allegiance is to the nation state and to their own people first and foremost.
Well, I completely agree with that. I think the first problem with doing such a thing is that there is denial that there is any such thing as a native British person. That's something that they've neutralized, that concept. So,
well, that's a scandal.
Oh, of course it is. And also just an assault on common sense. I mean, of course there is such a thing as someone who descends from these isles over the last 1,000 years and more. Yeah. Just because a lot of people arrived since 1945 really doesn't mean anything at all.
Yeah.
I think that traditional Britain groups still supports the 1970 Conservative Party general election manifesto, where they said that they would halt immigration and that they would set up an agency to encourage voluntary repatriation, and we think that is needed more today than it was in 1970. We need to be funding people to relinquish their civic citizenship, another scandal, and to send them on their way. Let them take their national insurance contributions. Let them take any money they've made in Britain. Let them sell their houses and take their profits with them. But we should be making some effort to encourage immigrants to go back to their natural homelands, which is where they belong. They don't belong here. Everybody remembers Enoch Powell always referred to immigrants as aliens, and the description of an alien in the dictionaries is someone who does not belong here any more then you or I would be long in Nigeria or China or India. You know, all of these countries told the British to get out. When we had our empire and our colonies, they said, we don't want you here anymore. Even Mrs. Gandhi went one step further, and she sacked thousands and thousands of British people who worked the civil service in India, and she sacked them purely on the basis that they were British and white. Nobody said anything. I mean, you know, there's got to be a point where the country says, we've got to reverse this. If we don't reverse this, we're finished. At the moment, they're saying, we need more housing. There's got to be more housing. The party's not doing enough for housing. Both parties, the main parties in government, are saying this on a daily basis. What they're really saying is that we need seven cities the size of Birmingham built in our green and pleasant land. That's what they're actually saying. And it's a disgrace. It's an absolute disgrace. We cannot build over Britain to, you know, to make sufficient accommodation available for people that should not be here. And a lot of people say, oh, well, it's not for them. Okay, well, it's for the people, the white flight people, the people who say, no, we're not racists. But at the same time, they sell up their property because their street has been taken over by aliens. So we reach a situation in London and in Leicester and now in Birmingham, where more than 50% of the population are aliens. And you might well ask yourself, where have all the white people, all the indigenous people, the British people, where have they gone? Well, they've all moved out. And a lot of the housing, if not most of the housing, being built in the countryside is where they're moving to. They're moving out of the ghettos to get away from the aliens, but they won't admit it. They won't say it openly. They say, oh, we did it for the children because they like the fresh air. Well, how come our parents didn't say, oh, well, the children like a bit of fresh air. We're all going to sell up. Well, they didn't. Nobody did. And of course, even in 1970, you could have got a lot more for a house in the city and in the suburbs than you would have paid in the countryside. In fact, it would have been easier to move in 1960 or 1970 to the countryside than it is today. And so this is just another big lie that we're all being fed on top of all the other lies.
Yes. There are plenty of examples where this has occurred, which is an indication of what is going to happen a little bit further down the road. Take London, for instance. The Cockneys were the ancestral inhabitants of London since the birth of that city, a millennia ago, I suppose, and they have now been reduced to minority status in London. For the most part, they've moved out to Essex, but Essex is being encroached by the same immigration problems. So where are they going to go next? I mean, they can't go into the sea. It's becoming a situation of bedlam. And I use the word carefully because I was talking to someone on the railway fairly recently about the stabbing epidemic in London. We've all heard about that. Stabbing's going on everywhere. I asked this question. I said, well, who's responsible for all of these stabbings? Could it be Presbyterians down from Scotland? Could it be them who are responsible? Could it be Welsh Methodists? Are they responsible? Or might it be Surrey and Sussex farmers who've come up to engage in this criminality? I said, well, we all know who it is. We know who's doing it, but we're not allowed to say it, are we?
Well, indeed. I don't think that anyone is under any illusions about this, except for the most the most airheaded liberal might, I guess, tell himself, we just don't know. It could be anyone. Anyone's susceptible to poverty. I think most people know exactly who is doing all these stabbings. Actually, I just saw today that Liverpool, the city of Liverpool, is now so diverse that it's having to install emergency stab stations around the city for people to treat stab wounds before the paramedics arrive, because of course the paramedics are now waylaid with all this stuff. So the public, I guess, are going to have to learn how to use this equipment to treat stab wounds. I mean, this is absolutely astounding, isn't it? There's just no... Yeah, it's very evil.
Well, you know, what about our elderly? They can't venture out at night. They can't venture out in the daytime. They're frightened to death if they happen still to live in the inner city areas of London or Birmingham or Liverpool. And this is the sort of society that is going to be imposed upon our children and our children's children. Heaven forbid that the writing is on the wall. We can see what's going to happen. And if people carry on voting for the Uniparty, then we're signing our own death warrant. It's rather like Enoch Powell said when he referred to building up our funeral pyre higher and higher and then setting light to it. That is what we're doing by voting for these people. No one should vote for these parties. I recommend that everyone writes a choice comment down alongside the Uniparty candidates and place that into the ballot box. The returning officer shows the candidates at each election the voting slips that have been spoiled, and then they can read what people are saying about them. That's the only way to defeat it at the moment, just to show that we haven't got any sympathy with them. Because if we carry on voting for them, then we're going to get what we voted for.
You see, these people are moving out of the cities. They think they're escaping, you see? But you can't run forever. Like a criminal, you can't run forever. I mean, eventually, the truth will hit home. And as they are expecting in France, there's going to be fantastic civil disorder. Enoch Powell predicted it in England. Rather, he was a prophet in many respects, and I think that he predicted it would happen here. It's just a question of time. It's just a question of time, and we have a House of Commons that doesn't care, and anybody that speaks out against the alien invasion, if that's the right word, of our country, is treated as a racist and a fascist and all the rest of it, and then they try and pin them down on some hate crime. Well, they can go on and they can do that. But it won't stop the reality. It won't stop the march of time. And eventually it'll all implode. I probably won't be here to see it, but unfortunately my children will be. It's very sad that we can't have a proper conversation about this without being smeared and libeled and all the rest of it. By people whose head is in the sand.
Yes, there's never been any conversation. The BBC has deliberately promoted the multicultural society. It's deliberately promoted globalist policies. And the only way that one can look at this is if one understands that the Uniparty parties, the sub-parties within the Uniparty, have been completely hijacked and taken over by globalist interests, by globalist financial interests, globalist political interests, and therefore they're representing the globalist agenda. They're not representing the national agenda. It's the only way to look at it, and that's why we have got increasingly a society of repression and oppression, and this is not going to get any better. It's going to get worse. That is why it's so important that we stop voting for the Uniparty, and the sooner we can get an opposition party that will oppose these policies, and I'm not talking about reform, because I think that is an establishment safety valve, and I would say there is only one thing that the establishment abhors, and that is a vacuum, because if there's a vacuum there, it can be filled. Now, that reform party is there for a purpose. It can be manipulated. It may not be within the complete control of the establishment, but it's there to be manipulated and pushed in the direction that suits the establishment, because it's not a proper opposition party. We need a patriotic party equivalent to the AFD in Germany, the National Rally in France, the Vox Party in Spain, the Northern League in Italy, or the Freedom Party in Austria. Something like Orbán in Hungary, in effect. He has the mass support of the ordinary people, and it should be perfectly feasible to organise something like that over here if we have the right leaders available to us. I'm just wondering, at this point, Colin, are you opening it up for questions today?
Yes, we are. But on that note, what do either of you think about the prospects of Nigel Farage rescuing this situation and creating a new party? He hints at this sometimes. Gregory?
Well, Nigel Farage spent years building up the UKIP. And then he spectacularly ditched them. Basically, he destroyed the party that he built up. He's a bit of a me person, isn't he? It's all about me. I think after the UKIP experience that I wouldn't have significant confidence in Farage. I think that he's a bit of a maverick. I think some of the things he says are good, but I can't help thinking that he's playing to the gallery for his own popularity. Whereas we in the TBG are playing to the gallery because we want them to hear what we're saying and do something about it, put it into votes or something. But Nigel, I think, where does Nigel stand really on anything? He was a banker. He worked in the city. And I mean, you know, banking is international. I see Nigel as something of a liberal, really. He's not a nationalist, I don't think. And I think, you know, just going back to what Andrew was saying, that we're looking at a House of Commons full of socialists who are naturally internationalist, socialists and internationalists. And on the other side, we have the liberals. And liberals are internationalists, not for the reasons that the socialists are internationalists, but because internationalism is based on the movement of capital and investment and all that sort of thing. So, I mean, I think that, I don't think I could have any particularly great confidence in Nigel. Sorry.
Okay. Andrew, would you have anything to say about Nigel Farage?
Well, personally, I think he's spineless, absolutely spineless on the crucial issues. the British public, since we went into the EU, the common market as then it was, opinion polls, for the most part, showed a majority that wanted to come out. And he was the man that that led the out movement, along with some a selection of Conservatives and a small number of Labour people as well. He was the big voice, but he wasn't a proper opponent to the establishment. What was the point? I remember asking him this a long time ago. What was the at a meeting, the PAC meeting of UKIPers? What was the point of wishing to maintain the integrity of the nation state when, as a result of massive immigration into the realm, there would be no nation left to preserve within a generation or two? And that was a question he skirted around. He wasn't able to get at the nux of the issue, which was the displacement and the replacement of the British people in order deliberately to render obsolete the nation state for globalist purposes. Getting out of the EU is one thing, and much as I applaud that, we've still got international governance which is percolating down from invisible sources, coming down from the World Health Organization, down from the United Nations, down from the World Economic Forum, and various other globalist bodies. And I haven't heard Farage say anything that I'm aware of that opposes that internationalist, globalist approach. So we're switching one bureaucracy for another governance of invisible bureaucrats. So far as his record is concerned, this is worth, there are some points that are worth noting here. I think it was in The Guardian where Nigel Farage described Mandela as his favourite political hero, and he promoted him to a sort of Christ-like figure. But if you Google The Guardian and Nigel Farage, Nelson Mandela, I think you'll find the reference in there. I recommend everyone look that up. They'll get the exact quotes there. That seemed an anomaly. After the brutal murder of Lee Rigby, a day or two later, Nigel Farage was in a mosque, and he took with him four or five of his MEP intake from the 2014 election. What was he doing in a mosque? He just had a British soldier killed on the streets by some Islamic fanatic. I find that absolutely bewildering. I've got a press release that Farage issued, must have been 10, 15 years ago, where he condemns the government for racism, for allowing in Eastern European immigrants at the expense of our traditional Commonwealth immigrants. I found that astonishing as well. I'll give you another example. I think it was back in 2010, during the 2010 elections. He was on, I think it was Andrew Neil's programme, saying that he thought Britain needed to issue about 250,000 work visas each year. Well, we all know once you get a work visa issued, then you've got dependents, especially if you've got children, you've got a wife or children to come in as well. So you can add to that hundreds of thousands more, potentially. And this is at a time when we were full up. And yet, here we are, he was advocating more immigration in the form of work visas. Why should we be undermining our own working men and women by importing hundreds of thousands every five-year period immigrants or issuing work visas from abroad, and thereby undermine the going rate of the of their labour? So when you put all of these things and more together, and incidentally, he's not trusted by a number of nationalists on the continent who are in elected positions. Why are we giving this man any credibility at all? He's, in my opinion, he's not on our side. He is a safety valve for the establishment. That's my opinion. I think many people would share that. And for those people who don't know, they should do a little bit of Googling and look up some of Farage's quotations and statements and policy measures in the past. Apart from that, I think he's got a massive and monstrous ego, and he appears quite incapable of working alongside anyone. You can tell by the number of MEPs he lost in 2004 to 2009. He seems to have lost a hell of a lot of people when he was leading UKIP. Now, perhaps there's more to this than meets the eye. I wouldn't know. I give him a... Perhaps you should ask him on and see if he'll join this program. He gets plenty of airing in on GB News. But ask him on. Question him about immigration. Question him about some of the points I've made. Question him about some of these statements. But I can lay a bet on it that he won't dare come onto a program like this and be subject to proper scrutiny and to proper questions to get at the backdrop of what it is he really stands for.
Yeah, I agree. I wouldn't even try to contact him to invite him on. I think it would be absolutely futile. Well, we should get to the questions. So there are a few super chats posted. Pure Nomad says thanks TB, TBG and Woz Deus Volt. Thank you. Maybe next time says happy solstice and Merry Christmas to all. Darby says, was Enoch Powell the biggest what if in British political history? Yes, I would say so. But it's pretty obvious what if. It's not a question. I think he would have rescued the country. But
yes, Greg, absolutely. Yeah. I think he would have. He was brilliant on economics, and he was absolutely right on alien immigration, which is the biggest threat that this country has ever faced. Forget about Hitler and Napoleon and all these others. Immigration is what is going to sink our country, our nation, our people. Why? Because there's no such a thing as assimilation. It's a liberal socialist wet dream. We are not all the same, which is what they're teaching the children. We're not all the same. We are different. And we'll always be different. You can't change a 20,000-year psyche and make it like ours in a decade of living in Britain. It's just a stupid nonsense. And imagine if your parents went to work in China and they had three children while they were working there. And it is completely ludicrous to suggest to those children that they're Chinese. And we've got to stop this. There's got to be radical, determined, radical action before there's total chaos. That's my view anyway.
Yeah.
And happy Andrew... Christmas to you all.
Andrew, Enoch Powell?
Yes, greatest Prime Minister who never was. Thrown out of the... given cold shoulder by Edward Heath, became persona non grata in the Conservative Party. But I remember him for one particular intervention. It was in Prime Minister's Question Time around about 1986. It was just after the Anglo-Irish Agreement. This time it wasn't on immigration or the EU, on which he was extremely sound on both. It was on the Anglo-Irish Agreement. And he asked Mrs. Thatcher in the House, does the Right Honourable Lady appreciate, and if she doesn't now, she soon will, that the price of treachery is public contempt. And he sat down, and Mrs. Thatcher got up and admitted that she was wounded by his remarks. Well, you could ask that same question of every MP on the major issues which we're facing today, and it would be interesting to see how they replied. But that was one thing that stood out, and everyone knows about his interventions on the common market and on the immigration situation. That was back in 1968 when he made his Rivers of Blood speech, and we were only having tens of thousands then. It was something like 40,000 coming in. We've now got, 1.3 million gross, so you can do the mathematics on it. It's incredibly sad. We didn't fight two world wars to become second-class citizens in our own ancestral homeland, and the previous generations, including my own family, forebears, fought in those two world wars, and none of them would be able to recognize Britain if they were placed in the middle of London today, excepting perhaps for the buildings.
Yeah. And there's a question about, right, Rogue Trader says, open looting and larceny, £37 billion on the Track and Trace app, and a mobile app. Even adjusted for inflation, that's 1.5 times the cost of the Channel Tunnel. I checked this, and it's not quite that, but you are basically correct. It was £35 million for the app, but the Track and Trace program had a budget of £37 billion. So that's, hold on a second. £30 billion. £30 billion over 2 years. So over the Track and Trace thing. Now, that is absolutely staggering. And I just checked the cost of the Channel Tunnel today's money was £22 billion. So the government spent more on the Track and Trace program than on the Channel Tunnel. That is just astonishing. I don't know. It makes your eyes water to think about how much COVID actually cost this country. It just is incredible sums. Ultimate truth. Replacement migration is occurring in every European nation by design. It's not a party political issue. I agree. I think that is true. I don't want to read out the rest of your comment, though, for reasons that I think you'll understand. Aethelward, hold on a second. Oh, yes. All right. I know this is a controversial question to say, but if hypothetically we did get into power and we were certain to deport these people from our island, I believe it's likely only state-enforced action would work. There's no point talking about that because it's ultimately just LARPing to talk about how we would do it. We're nowhere near getting power, so it's not a question that we need to consider. Pure Nomad, are we going to be the last ancestral people in the UK watching Millennial in 2060 asking these same questions? In the voice of Bob Geldof, we need your change before these people die. That is true, and I hope that people who are good at organising put together a political party and take on the establishment, or whatever approach is needed to dislodge the political parties. We said earlier about abolishing first past the post, replacing it with proportional representation. I think that would be a huge step forward. Gregory, would you like to say anything about that?
I've always believed that if you really believe in democracy and you believe that every vote should count for something, then you must believe in proportional representation. We can't have a situation where in a constituency Everybody's voted, say 50,000 people have voted. 33,000 people vote against the bloke that wins, and he only wins with 18,000 votes. The 32,000 whose votes were cast, they go nowhere. They mean nothing. They're meaningless votes under our system. That can't be right. Yeah, I mean, I can't believe that anybody believes that that's right. Every vote, as far as is possible, should count for something. And that is why proportional representation is good, because that's what happens. It also demonstrates that, yes, you can have a lot of other parties. You can have maybe 3 or 4 or 5 other parties. And people say, oh, well, that's no good. We have stability here where they don't have stability on the continent. Well, that's a really rancid argument, because what you're basically saying is that we know how to do it, but nobody else does. They have stability on the continent, but they also have democracy.
Yeah, it's as if to say that on the continent they're just constantly living in a state of political chaos. Which simply isn't the truth.
That isn't true. And I think that, you know, the situation is that if you really believe in democracy and you believe that as many votes as cast should count, then you must believe in proportional representation. Otherwise, what you're saying is that you believe, I think in the last sort of 50 years, no party in government's got more than 44% of the vote. So what you're saying is that 56% of the vote for the last 50 years has meant nothing. Those votes were all thrown into the garbage tin. That's just not democracy. It's not the way forward. And if we had proportional representation, you know, there'd be a party that you could vote for. Say you didn't like the mafia that we are under at the moment. You'd have an opportunity to vote for a party knowing that when you voted for that party, that it actually had a chance of getting into parliament. Whereas at the moment, we know that nobody has any chance of getting in because the two big mafia parties have got it all sewn up. It's not democracy, sorry. It's just not.
Yeah. There are a few other super chats. So, Andrew, if you could answer this quite briefly, thank you.
Yeah, I mean, well, I've got a Conservative MP where I live, the majority is about 20,000 or something like that, but that really means 19,999 votes completely wasted, because you only need a majority of one to get in. Most people don't go along with his left-wing globalist policies, which brings me on to the point your previous questioner raised about immigration, which is going on everywhere. Well, it is going on everywhere. It's a globalist policy to subvert the nation states and Western civilization, overturn the whole thing, destroy the culture and identity of Western European civilization, and bring about its complete overthrow and destruction. So yes, that's a globalist policy, rather like all the other ones, the LGBT agenda, the climate change agenda, the various other topics we've discussed tonight, the Ukraine war, the lockdowns, all of that sort of thing. These are all globalist policies that have been imposed upon us, and immigration is just one of those.
Right. Okay, and the Black, okay, there are quite a few super chats from Black Pigeon Pilled. He asks, is there a role for aristocracy in Britain in the 21st century? Gregory.
Ah, right. Well, I'm a traditionalist. I'm a real Tory, and I'm a traditionalist. And I believe the aristocracy have played a very important role in Britain since the Dark Ages. And I think we've entered a new Dark Age with Tony Blair and his 1999 Act. We now see a House of Lords full of spivs, full of people that have, you know, got no merit whatsoever. And the House of Lords was constructed and built for the hereditary peerage. Now, you either believe in the hereditary principle or you don't. You either believe that your children should have everything that is yours. You believe in the father to son to father to son to father to son system, which is always operated in our country. Moreover, our monarchy is based on the hereditary principle. So if you're opposed to the hereditary principle in the House of Lords, then you must be completely opposed to the monarchy. If you're going to have an elected House of Lords, then presumably the next step is an elected monarch or a president. And that's not the British way. We have always had a hereditary House of Lords. And Blair's socialist bill, his hate bill, it was a socialist hate bill to get rid of the hereditary peerage, was a scandal. And the Conservative Party should have fought it every inch of the way, but they didn't. A clear demonstration that they were no longer a Conservative Party. They completely failed on one of the great institutions of our nation, and that was the House of Lords. We now have the most appalling shower of people in the House of Lords who are just ghastly. And apart from the 92 hereditaries who have hung on. So, yes, I do believe that the aristocracy have a role, because we've seen over the last century that when the House of Commons has been off the rails and have been trying to bring in all kinds of ludicrous legislation, the old hereditary peerage were the first ones to put the brakes on it and say, well, we're not going to do that. Whereas now we have so many political placemen in the Lords who have got there purely because of party politics, that it's just a shambles. It's just totally debased. We need the hereditary peerage, and we need to repeal Blair's 1999 Act. It's never too late. It's never too late. While there's life, there's hope. Think of our country, our culture, our traditions, our heritage, and they are all encapsulated in the hereditary peerage. So that's the only way forward, in my view.
Okay. What is the TBG's policy concerning the Commonwealth? Is it worth preserving or best abandoned? Which of you would like to take this?
I'll deal with that, if I may comment. Just going back onto Gregory's point, the great thing about the aristocracy is that they didn't need, they were independent. They didn't need to join themselves to a political party, and therefore they came up with views and policies which were their own, and moulded in the interests of the country, of course. But I'm afraid, and I must say this, and Gregory hasn't mentioned it, that many of them deserted the post. That wasn't the case in World War One. And I can look at my father's photograph. He fought in World War One, and he's sitting for the photograph, the Household Battalion, and on that row there are four peers of the realm. The loss of blood by the aristocracy was enormous in World War One, far higher than for any other category, I think. But perhaps because of that and the genetic loss, they never recovered. And I have to say that with rights and privileges come responsibilities, and there are many aristocrats who failed to stand up because, frankly, they were cowards. They didn't have it within them to confront the situation, which they should have done. And had they done it early enough, this country might not be in the position it is today. So I would say that as a qualifying point. Brings me on to the next question, the Commonwealth. If we're talking about the old Commonwealth, there we have ties. We're talking about Australia, New Zealand, Canada. At one time, it would have been South Africa and Rhodesia as well. We have ties. They are ties of blood. They are countries to whom we are naturally affiliated. We have very large trading relations. However much the EU tried to imperil those, we still have them. And I think there should be free movement between our kith and kin in the old Commonwealth, the Dominions. But that's as far as it goes. We have nothing in common with the new Commonwealth. Clearly, we want to be on the best terms and relations with them, but that does not involve freedom of movement into Britain. And generally, you only get freedom of movement from a poorer country to a richer country. If the current trend continues, of course, we will all have to seek refuge in the new Commonwealth. That said, as a passing aside, perhaps. But we must maintain the closest relations with our old Commonwealth, because we're bound to them by blood, and it's as simple as that.
Yes, I agree. Here's a question for Gregory. Who is your favourite British monarch?
Edward the First.
All right, and why?
I think because he was a great monarch. He was a no-nonsense monarch. He didn't stand any nonsense from anybody. And he led us to great victories against the French. And he ran the country with an iron rod. And there was a place for everyone, and everyone knew their place. And, you know, democracy has been like a cancer. Our type of democracy, I mean, has been like a cancer and has seen in the space of 150 years the total destruction of everything that our ancestors fought for and built. Can I just say on the Commonwealth is I can't see any point in maintaining the Commonwealth, because it's not a Commonwealth. I've lost count of the number of countries that have said, oh, we don't want the British monarch to be our monarch, and who are constantly slagging us off about ridiculous things like slavery, which occurred 200 years or more ago, as though it's relevant in the 21st century. And I think a lot of these countries asked us to leave. They said they didn't want to be colonies anymore, but they still want the handouts. They still want the overseas aid. And they want to be in the Commonwealth because that brings a sort of, oh, we're in the British Commonwealth, can't you help us? Well, the answer is no. We can't help you. And we don't want to help you, what is more. Because you departed. You left the house and the door was slammed shut. And so it's cheerio for now. As Andrew said, we have blood ties. Blood is everything. And we have blood ties with the Australians, with the New Zealanders, with the Canadians. And yes, we should build up our relationships with these countries. That previous generations of our disgusting politicians rather destroyed with joining the European Economic Community and the European Union, instead of trading with our natural partners. And so, yes, the old Commonwealth, fine. But I think the new Commonwealth, it's goodbye. That's my view. Yeah.
All right. Andrew?
Well, is the question on a favourite monarch or...
Yes.
Favourite monarch, with my Scottish hat in my head, I would say Robert Bruce. With my English residence hat on my head, I would say Elizabeth I, who was a great monarch. There was an instance in those days when it was fashionable for upper middle class families to have black manservants. And she summoned her royal court and she stated something along the lines, "It has come to our attention," using the royal plural, "that there are diverse blackamoors within this realm. They will be removed forthwith from here." And they were. They were taken to wherever it was, Africa or wherever, and they were removed. but of course, that was one aspect of her law, her realm. And the other was, of course, defeating the Spanish Armada in 1588. So a great monarch, and there you are in a nutshell.
Okay, thank you very much. Not Finished says, "Fear is the greatest motivator, and death is the greatest fear for most people. The death penalty is a must to prevent another Rotherham." And also just deportation of the families of anyone found guilty of that kind of thing. I think we can all agree on that. He also says, "Governments in Western Europe and the US are cracking the eggshell of democracy, trying to ban parties such as the AfD, trying to ban presidential candidates such as Trump, supporting Israel in bombing hospitals. The people aren't buying it. An epochal shift is happening. We are witnessing a downfall of, presumably, of the post-war order." I wanted to ask you both about the Gaza conflict and its repercussions, but we ended up talking about other things for so long that we didn't get to it. Would you see that as I think it is likely. I think that we are seeing, if not an epochal shift, definitely a change in the tenor of political life, geopolitics. I think the public no longer feel the same about democracy as they did 5 years ago, and also about Israel as well. I think that gives the lie to so many lies. Andrew?
Yes, I think if you look back to the 1950s, the Conservative Party had something like 3 million members, an enormous number compared with what they have today, which is probably about 150,000. I'm not certain of the exact figure, but a tiny fraction of what it was then. The Labour Party in those days had about 1 million members. And if you look back to the 1950s, the two-party system probably held almost all the seats in the UK mainland in the Houses of Parliament, perhaps half a dozen with the Lib Dems. And probably in those days, the turnout was about in the high 70s. Today, the turnouts are falling. They fell all the way down to about 60% in Tony Blair's time. And I think Tony Blair, although he had a majority, out of the entire electorate, he got elected with only about 23% of the entire electorate supporting him. I wonder what's going to happen in the next election. Will people feel they have to vote Labour to get rid of the Conservatives who've made an absolutely atrocious mess of the country? Or will people refrain from voting? And I think there's going to be a big number who just don't bother to vote at all. So, yes, I think that's where we're heading, and the epochal shift is occurring because people do not believe what they're being told. And if they were believing up until the pandemic and the lockdowns, that wakened very many people, and they then began to doubt their leaders for the first time in many instances. And with the advent of alternative media brought about by the internet, there are alternative news sources, and that is striking fear into the heart of the establishment in this country and every other Western civilized nation. On the continent, the AFD has got over 20% of the vote, which in terms of proportional representation would bring them an enormous number of seats in the next general election there. In France, the National Rally is going great guns. In Austria, the FPÖ is doing extremely well. But smaller parties like Vox that have appeared out of nowhere. So there is a change, and that is opposition to the globalist policies of the uniparties, both here and overseas. So I think your commentator is right. I think that is occurring. Whether it can occur quickly enough to halt the situation and turn it around at this moment still remains to be seen.
Yes. Someone said Twitter is a PR disaster for politicians and their handlers. So, yeah, certainly agree. Gregory, would you have anything to say about a shift occurring due to COVID, the assaults on democracy and the Gaza conflict?
Well, I don't think there's much you can do about the COVID crisis. It's past. We've spent all the money. They made all the mistakes. And I think just going on talking about it now is probably a complete waste of time. The only thing that has come out of the COVID crisis is the principle of being of enforced vaccinations. I think in any free society, you can't enforce vaccination for an influenza. You know, there are vaccinations for things like polio and horrendous things of that nature, and I think that they should be compulsory instead of seeing a whole lot of cripples surrounding us. But COVID was just a flu vaccination, and I don't think the government had any right, any legal right to enforce partially tested vaccines on us. Gaza's very sad. I think that, most people don't realize what has happened in Palestine. They don't realize that this is a classic case of the immigrants coming in such vast numbers that they quickly, within the space of about 60 years, overtook the indigenous population, and then they proceeded to murder them, to steal their land, to expel them from their homes and villages, to demolish their homes and villages after they'd expelled them so that they could not come back to them, and to push them into refugee camps in the Lebanon, in Transjordan, and in the Gaza Strip. So here we have a situation of the immigrants taking over the indigenous population's country, and they're still murdering them on a daily basis. This ought to be a lesson, actually, for all European countries. As to what can be done in Gaza, well, as long as the United States shore up the Israelis, it's just going to continue until there's none left. Basically, it's fantastic. I mean, the Israeli army said to everybody in North Gaza, you've got to get out and go to the south for your own safety. So as soon as they did that, the Israelis started bombing the south. So they said, well, we think maybe you should try and go into Sinai. But basically what they're doing is they're ethnically cleansing Palestine and Gaza of the indigenous population. Then we get the people that say, oh, but they're Islamic, you know, they're terrorists and all this sort of thing. But, you know, we if we were If our country was taken over by aliens, we'd fight back and we'd be the same terrorists here. We'd be fighting back against the immigrants here if they took over our country. And that's what's happened there. The indigenous population have taken over the country, and it's nothing to do with their religion. It's all to do with the immigrants taking over their country. And it's very, very sad. And I'm very, very disappointed that intelligent people can't actually see this, because enough very fine people have written about the disgrace that is Palestine. Yeah.
Okay, thank you very much. That's a very good answer. Okay, Ben asks, what can we do to encourage high-quality people to become involved and contribute to changing the future? I would say the first thing is that people need to get together. And this is why organizing and organizations are targeted by the establishment, because it's the beginning, resistance to their tyranny. Gregory.
Yes, I'd agree with that. But the problem is that the left are now so powerful in Great Britain that people are afraid to put their heads above the parapet. They're afraid of losing their jobs. They're being targeted by the far left. Their employers are telephoned. They said, why are you employing fascists? Why are you employing Nazis? And these people then lose their jobs, and so they lose their livelihood. They can't pay their mortgages, so they lose their home. People are not prepared to take these risks. There is no protection anymore for people like you and I to speak out. The left have got the floor. They've got the stage. And you're down there in the bowels of the theater, and there's nothing you can do. So it's very, very, very hard. We in the Traditional Britain Group have found, we booked a London club where we had been before for our conference, and they, after signing the contract and saying they were looking forward to hosting us, blah, 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 blah. Then about a month later, they said, oh, no, we're not going to have people like you here. And their solicitors wrote a letter saying that no decent society would have us anywhere near them. So we sued them. We sent a letter before action. And they didn't have a leg to stand on, actually, under the Equalities, the 2010 Equalities Act. So they didn't have a leg to stand on because they were actually discriminating against us because of our political philosophy. Yes. So they were stuffed. So they had to pay damages to us, or they didn't have to, but they did. And we then had another hotel which did the same thing to us. And so we're just waiting for their out-of-court settlement now. And the third, another hotel, which had our booking for 8 months, they had our booking. And throughout that 8 months, we're in constant discussion with them and talking about the arrangements and all the rest of it. And then 9 days before the conference was due to take place, they wrote to us and said that they weren't going to have us in their hotel because we were opposed to multiculturalism, and they didn't like some of the speakers that we'd had at previous conferences. Well, you know, we've had brilliant, excellent first-class speakers from across the world at our conferences. We've even had a Nobel Prize winner. So, you know, we're just about to take these people into the court. And let's see how they argue their way through this. Because they deliberately discriminated against us because of our political philosophy. And they haven't got a leg to stand on. And this is the kind of thing that's going on against organizations such as ours who just want to talk, to discuss ideas, to hear speakers, to hear ideas, and to talk about these ideas amongst ourselves. The establishment are determined, and the left wing, the far left, are in cahoots with the establishment. And they are determined to close organizations like us down. So you're asking, you asked, how do we get good, decent people to come on board? Well, because they're all frightened to death, that's why.
Yeah, and I think the solution is, as someone says, counter lawfare, such as you are doing right now. I think that's a great idea, because it shows people that we do have legal recourses. We're not just the victims of whatever the establishment chooses to do to us.
Why should British people in their own country be treated like this? You wouldn't be treated like this if you were black.
No, of course not. Of course. Andrew?
Yeah. It really is extraordinary. I mean, these aren't public meetings we're trying to hold. I mean, that would be disgraceful enough to try and close down a public meeting to prevent the public from coming to hear what we were trying to say. But these were private meetings amongst our own members and supporters. Private meetings which were not open to the public. And yet the enemy tried to close them down. What were they doing to close them down? Were they threatening violence against the hotel in question? They must have phoned through hundreds, if not more, hotels to try and find out where we were holding our conference. Just imagine if this was the other way around, if it was the right that was threatening violence against hotels that were holding, I don't know, pro-immigration meetings or communist meetings or Labour Party meetings or whatever it is. Can you imagine it? These, that the right would be closed down. It would be prescribed by the government. We would be labelled a terrorist organisation. But when it happens the other way around, we're there discussing issues of import to ordinary British people, then it's not allowed, and we are free game. We're there to be persecuted and hounded, and that's where we've got in this country.
Yeah, that is the situation, and it will only stop if we fight back against it. And this is why we need, as I say, to use lawfare. I think it's the only way. And that also includes reputational damage, slander against us, against individuals among us, because that also discourages people from getting involved. All of this stuff matters.
But, you know, to go to court for slander and libel, defamation, under Tony Blair's new act, to the 2013 Act, it costs thousands of pounds just to issue proceedings. Thousands. People don't have this kind of money, and there's no legal aid available. So the defamation against the individual stands in the papers, in the magazines, you know, in all the left-wing filth. The defamations against you stand, unless you're very, very, very rich. I give you an example.
We're already well over time, so
Sorry.
But the point is made and clear. Okay. And Not Finished says, unfortunately, ethnic conflict is guaranteed to happen in our countries. We didn't ask for it, we don't want it, but we will suffer it. Everyone should train like their life depends on it, because it does. That's a grim message, but I think probably true. Black Pigeon Pilled asks, which political figure does Gregory and Andrew as a whole take the most interest in? It's a theme about Mogg. As for Farage, I always reckoned him as a wrong un. So the political figures that you think are have promise. Gregory, you put this one.
Current political figures?
Yes.
I can't think of one.
Okay, that's a good short answer. Presumably in other countries there are better candidates.
Yeah, yes, I think there are. I can't think of anyone that is standing up, any real conservative that will stand up and say all the things that we're saying. I can't think of anyone who has leadership qualities that would take us out of the quagmire, the liberal left swamp that our country is currently struggling in. I really can't. We are facing a catastrophe.
Yes. Okay, Andrew, any political figures you think have promise?
Well, if we put the clock back 20 or 30 years, it would have been enough power. Well, 40 years now, actually. Today, I agree with Gregory. I'm hard-pressed to find anyone here. Everyone is muted. They're frightened to stand up. There's plenty of people in personal conversation who have the right views and the correct ideas and so on, but they're not prepared to stand up. They don't want to be hounded by the media. They won't put their head over the parapet. Now, if I go to the continent, and I've been there as a guest of political friends in the past, I've gone to some of their events and functions, I'm astonished at the number of people who are prepared to stand up. And I'm talking about in their numbers, dentists, lawyers, accountants, doctors, surgeons, quite extraordinary. The number of people who are prepared at least to attend political events where they have some affinity. But here it's difficult to get people even to do that. There seems to be an extraordinary cowardice which has afflicted everyone now. It's a sort of mental state and condition where people are not prepared to put their head over the parapet, because of a whole host of Orwellian reasons, psychological warfare that's been visited on the population now for decades, and it's caused a lot of people to fall silent. And we need those people now. We need them to come to our meetings. We need them to organise. We need them to stand up and be counted. And if they don't do so, we're heading fastly into the 11th hour, and it'll simply be too late. We've got to do it now. Otherwise, within a generation's time, there will be no future.
Yeah, I agree. This is why it's imperative that we build up our organizations and encourage people to take part. Okay, well, there is one more super chat from Not Finished, and he simply says, thank you, gentlemen, for doing this stream. Merry Christmas and all the best in 2024. So I think that's a nice message to end with. This has been a very good stream. Thank you to Gregory and Andrew for agreeing to appear. Is there anything you'd like to say in closing before we finish? Gregory?
Well, I'd just like to wish everyone a happy and holy Christmas, and do go along to your church, because this is a Christian festival and it's about Christ, and our entire culture and history revolves around our Christianity. We went on crusade for Christianity, and we've got married in our churches, and we had our children baptized in our churches, and this is a very special occasion, Christmas, the birth of Christ. So do go along to the carol concert the night on Christmas Eve, and do try and go to your churches over Christmas. And I wish everyone a very, very happy New Year.
Thank you. Andrew?
I couldn't really put it better than Gregory's put it. I might also add this point, that Christianity is the antithesis of everything our enemy stands for. It's the antithesis, the very opposite, the mirror opposite of what the globalists stand for. So bear that in mind. And with that, I also would like to wish everyone a very happy Christmas and a great new year. And I hope to see in due course more of you attending our traditional Britain group. You can find the details of that on the internet.
Our website.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it's all linked below. So thank you very much. Okay. Well, I will I'll close this stream now. There's another one due imminently. So, yes, in the meantime, Gregory and Andrew, representing the Traditional Britain Group, thank you for appearing on Millennial 2023. Okay, bye-bye for now.
Goodbye.
We hope you're enjoying Millennial.
Goodbye.
The journey must continue, but it needs your help. There are many ways to make a cash donation. Find all of these at millennial.com/donate. Your kindness will be warmly appreciated.
All aboard.
Millennial amounts to 3 months of work for the vile vlogger. Please help him continue. Until next time, enjoy the journey and spread the word.